All the Rage with John Bowd on www.tracksfm.org.
Hello again, listeners. Welcome once again to All the Rage, and as we have been doing in these times, sending you love, peace, and solidarity around the world during this terrible pandemic. It hasn't gone away, despite what many of our political leaders would like to project, and human life is far more important than any economy. So I'm not sure what you say our solidarity is to you, but you've always got it. And that also goes out for Black Lives Matter, still the most important revolutionary global event I think that is happening right now. If you tuned in last week, thank you very much for doing so. You would have heard a good friend and Latin American correspondent, Francisco Dominguez, speaking about the region. But there's a lot happening in that wonderful part of the world. So we're going to do another go. We're going to come back on a couple of things and go into some other parts of the region we didn't discuss last week. So, Francisco, hello. How are you? Good to see you again. Hear you again.
Oh, thanks for having me again. Thanks for listening.
You're very welcome.
Good evening to everyone.
Yes, thank you for taking the time. Before we go on to parts anew for this week, we just wanted to come back on a couple of things we talked about last week. So I believe we have an update in regards Venezuela and the British court's decision over how they can deal with their gold, which is being held in this country.
Yeah, the judge, Nigel Tia, made the decision 10 days, 15 days ago, that on the basis of recognition by the UK government of Mr. Juan Guaido as the interim president of Venezuela, then a litigation presented by the Central Bank of Venezuela that the gold was given to the United Nations Development Program so that it can be used to fight against the pandemic, to buy, purchase, you know, health inputs, medicines and food, was rejected because of that recognition, and but also on the merits of Article 233, which suggests that the presidency of Venezuela is vacant, which is obviously ridiculous. But interestingly, the Central Bank of Venezuela has insisted on the matter, and the courts in here have decided that Venezuela, the Central Bank of Venezuela, is entitled to actually make an appeal, which is excellent. And they're ready to fight. I don't know exactly when the next hearing is going to take place. I'm waiting to get information about that. But the petition, if I may mention that, the petition sent by the Venezuela Solidarity Campaign is reaching 10,000 signatures already. And with this appeal, I think it's going to reach much more. It's quite important because Mr. Guaido doesn't control anything in Venezuela. Not sure whether he's even living there. And giving the gold to him is just not only absurd, it's totally ridiculous. And Venezuela needs it desperately to fight the pandemic. So, sort of good news. We'll see how this pans out.
Yeah, and I just want to add a point there is that there's many things we could say about Mr. Guaido, but any kind of recognition of him is totally and completely undemocratic and illegitimate. So I just want to say to people out there, some of whom I know, who believe international solidarity is meaningless and doesn't have any effect, well, in which case you're then signing off to say the government of this country where you live is perfectly obliged to act in a totally undemocratic way, thereby affecting the fate and everyday material existence of many people on other part of the planet. You might not care, but that is the fact of the matter. So that's a bit of a personal grind I'm doing there, but it's important. I believe everything I just said there. It's extremely important. So international solidarity does work. We, of course, posted that petition that you referred to last week, and we can post it again this week on the show description. So before we move on, Bolivia, I just wanted to highlight something. The other day, thanks to the great Guardian journalist Glenn Greenwald, he highlighted a tweet from Elon Musk. I should have something, you know, witty to say about Elon Musk, but I don't. I just think he's a psychopath. But apparently in one tweet, he admitted when someone pushed him on it to involvement in the Bolivian coup. Did you know, Francisco, do you know anything about this story or any more detail?
My understanding is that he was confronted with it because there is some evidence that he participated in the whole thing. And his reply, if I'm correct, said something like, was something like, I could, whenever I want, deal with it.
Yeah, that was it, yeah.
So that gives you an idea of how arrogant they are and how, you know, negative the situation has turned in Latin America, so that people like him believe that they have the right over the political life of the whole country by just doing what he did or claiming he did. And it's an indication how far the far right in the United States is prepared to go, and possibly they'll go further if they can. So it's disgusting, and it should be rejected by everyone.
Yes. And another good example of internationalism, when these people get together, look at the damage they can do, which is why the rest of us need to get together in order to prevent that damage from happening. Elon Musk is a classic example of, you know, if you pay attention to the news in this country, for instance, and I'm sure it's the same in many other parts of the world where people are listening to us now, they'll have you believe that, you know, drug dealing, pit bull terrier owning psychopaths on every street corner are the people to be most afraid of. To be honest, people like Elon Musk, I'm far, far more afraid of than I am anybody else who's I share a neighborhood with, even if they are proficient in violence when I'm not. But anyway, that's just my view. I don't want to get off the subject for this evening. So,
can I just say very briefly on Bolivia? It's just the, I mean, I know it's a small item today, but the government in Bolivia, I think we talked about this last week, is trying to outlaw the MAS, which is the political party of Evo Morales. And they haven't succeeded yet, but they're accusing the president, the former president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, of terrorism. Because on one occasion during the coup last year, he called on people to resist. And that is sufficient grounds for sections of the judiciary to charge him formally. He's been formally charged with terrorism. So that gives you an idea that they're using lawfare. You know, they seem the same way as this guy believes that he's entitled to wage a coup d'etat. They're using lawfare totally arbitrarily just to get their way, regardless of any decorum, I would say. You know, they just lost that. He's totally unscrupulous.
Now, moving on to Brazil. Where are we in this country?
There is a protracted crisis. The protracted crisis actually is three-dimensional. I don't like that word, but, you know, that's the one that came out. Mm. On the one hand, you have a massive political crisis because of Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro has produced chaos in the political establishment of Brazil at every level. Dilma Rousseff, in a meeting that held, we participated in a meeting with Jeremy Corbyn recently, a few days ago, she said that, you know, Bolsonaro's action, which was supported by the elite and the right wing, ended up producing a disappearance of the center, political center, but also the political disappearance of the right. And therefore, they're stuck with Bolsonaro, and Bolsonaro is causing havoc in every possible way. And there are sections of the military who are trying to put a straitjacket on him, trying to control him. And they sort of can to some degree, but not completely, because they don't want to appear as trying to impose a military government or a military dictatorship, which they would shy away from. Certainly, there are substantial sections of the military that do not want to go that way. So that's one crisis. And the left, which is very well organized, it's got the left organized on a broad level, include the social movements, trade unions, Afro-descendants, women, the LGBT community, indigenous communities, and so forth. It's not sufficiently strong at the institutional level to actually shift things in their favor, because the right wing still hold majorities in Congress, in the Senate, and certainly they control the judiciary and other parts of the Brazilian state, such as the police, the army, and so on. So the left, with this massive broad alliance that they set up, are not able to change things quite dramatically, but they're able to resist some things. And Bolsonaro is just producing chaos. So the political crisis is going to continue for a while. This is combined with a massive economic crisis. nobody knows exactly, but the GDP of Brazil is likely to contract to between 8% to 14%, depending on how the economy pans out. And the key reason for this is because the neoliberal agenda has been implemented by Bolsonaro, privatizing everything, you know, carrying out mass redundancies in the public sector, reducing wages all across the board, and, you know, taking every possible step to ensure that the rich continues to be richer or become richer and the poor just are marginalized, then this is reducing consumption massively in the country. And the consequence of that, you know, many businesses actually are going out of business, particularly small and medium-sized companies, which are the one that most generate employment. So therefore, you know, there is a crisis which is hitting the nation quite badly. And the economic policies of Bolsonaro just do not make sense at all. I mean, if you were part of a sort of coherent right-wing neoliberal program, you know, it would be nasty, but at least it will get them somewhere. Mm. But what they're doing is just applying a horrible neoliberal package and just handing over everything to the United States and to multinational companies in every possible respect, particularly the Amazonia, where the elite, and this is part of the plan of the United States and other multinational players, they want to open Amazonia because there are a substantial amount, it's been discovered, that there are substantial amounts of rare metals. Among them, there is lithium. And lithium is so, so appreciated by multinational companies. Many people actually suggest that the coup in Bolivia took place because of lithium. You know, the United States wanted the lithium. And after the election of left-wing president in Argentina, Alberto Fernandez, they couldn't contemplate the possibility of an alliance there. So they went for the coup immediately before Fernandez took office. And lithium is the key. Bolivia has the largest deposit of lithium in the world. And now, you know, this is likely to be privatized and given over to multinational companies from the United States. And in Brazil, it's the same. It's not only lithium, but it's plenty. And the only obstacle, sorry, I'm using this ironically, the only obstacle is the indigenous population. And therefore, you know, what they're doing, according to Dilma Rousseff, this is deliberate. They're deliberately allowing the contamination to take their toll as quickly and as broadly as possible so that these communities disappear. And they have much less protection normally, even though there are some institutional protections, legislation, institutions, and so on. They've been protecting not only the environment, but also the communities, the many indigenous communities that live there. Well, Bolsonaro, you know, has just ignored all of that and just going for it. And they didn't want to open Amazonia because of these minerals, which are, you know, extremely important and quite lucrative. And the consequences are disgusting. I mean, they are terrible, devastating, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands. This is not an exaggeration of indigenous communities are dying. They are contaminated, and many of them, because there are so many different ethnic groups, many of them are risking disappearing completely off the face of the earth because of this. And so that's one dimension, which is extremely important. And the economic crisis, which has this particular twist, is causing havoc in very significant communities. And the third dimension of the crisis is the COVID-19. Everybody knows the shenanigans with Mr. Bolsonaro. He said, I mean, one of the latest he came up with was that wearing a mask as a protection was a queer thing. Queer in the sense of being gay. Anybody who wears that will be a gay, which, you know, in some sections of the Brazilian elite is like an insult. It became sort of popular among sections of the population. And the consequence of this has been sending mixed messages to the population regarding there is no need to do this or the other, there is no need for any protection, no need for any lockdown. In fact, he organized public rallies in Brasilia, in Sao Paulo, and other big cities, for people, his supporters, to come out and say, we don't want any restriction of any kind whatsoever. And the consequence is just terrible. The latest figure from the Johns Hopkins University, which are producing, you know, the best figures in the world regarding the contamination in Brazil, now is 2,394,000 and going up. And the United States, 4,200,000. So that gives you an idea. Brazil is around two-thirds in terms of population of the U.S. population, and is nearly getting to the same level of the United States in terms of the number of people dying. The number of people that is 1,886,000 already. And that gives you an idea of the horror of a government which is totally responsible and is genocidal. That's what really Dilma Rousseff and the Workers' Party refer to him as. And therefore, these three components in the context of, you know, Trump going crazy about taking the most extreme measures, threatening everybody because he wants to be reelected no matter what. And this is giving license to people like Bolsonaro to continue to cause even more havoc. And therefore, the population now are beginning to feel really intimidated, threatened, and worried. So much so that even sections of the elite are actually getting extremely worried. And they give you a flavor of what is going on, so as a sort of introduction to the topic.
Yeah. On that last point, are there any sections of the right? I know you mentioned the military earlier on, and Brazil, as we know, is a country that's had military coups. But politically speaking, are there any sections of the right that are starting to move against Bolsonaro or consider it? Do we know any information like that?
Yes, there are. I mean, the most prominent of them all is a guy called Fernando Henrique Cardoso, who used to be president of Brazil. He was quite popular and sort of traditional right wing. He had an original Marxist background. He wrote a wonderful book, 1979, Capitalism and Development, which is one of the best books on how underdevelopment take place in peripheral societies such as Brazil. But then, you know, he moved on to the right consistently and he became the president of Brazil. He applied neoliberal policies and the consequences was massive inflation, huge crisis as a result of trying to apply, part of the neoliberal program. And then he lost the election. He still is highly respected. He took a sort of neutral stance regarding Bolsonaro at the beginning, pretending, you know, what is the Workers' Party for? What do you expect? Let's hope that this guy gets it right. But now he's become extremely vocal. This is one of them. There is another guy called, it was the president of the Congress. I can't remember his name now. I will come to me in a second, who was also come out quite strongly against Bolsonaro. And then significant members of the right wing have come out criticizing Bolsonaro, even somebody who sort of quite a maverick, but is quite, has a big impact in Brazilian politics, a guy called Ciro Gomes, who's come out referring to him as an SOB, quite publicly on national television, not once, several times because of his policies. So there are sections of the elite who realize how bad this guy is, but they're not prepared to take the next step, which is, you know, how about organizing some serious charges against his irresponsible genocidal attitude, not only with the country, but also with the population, and let's get him out of power, which is the position of the Workers' Party. The Workers' Party has come to the position that actually the only way to deal with the crisis that has been created, this three-dimensional crisis that has been created as a result of, first, the impeachment of Dilma, secondly, the election of Bolsonaro, third, the preventing Lula from being the candidate, is just by impeaching Bolsonaro. She says, you know, we have to build a sufficiently strong alliance at the level of society, but also at the level of the institutional framework in Brazil, particularly the Congress, and the Senate, but also among the judiciary, in order to be able to get rid of this guy. And she says, unless we deal with this problem, we will not be able to deal with any of the three aspects of the three-dimensional crisis that the country faces. And therefore, the Workers' Party is pushing very hard for this, and the right wing has the option. Should we go for impeachment and maybe, you know, face an election where the Workers' Party will come back and restore the gains being lost as a result of the neoliberal period that Brazil has faced? Or shall we continue, shall we try to not have the Workers' Party, but then, you know, have to put up with Bolsonaro and whatever else he does and produces? So that's their dilemma. I doubt that this position of waiting for something new to happen is sustainable in the long run. And what I mean the long run is, you know, the next year or so, because there will be elections in 2022. So time is running out for them. They have to come up with something. And the worst nightmare from the right wing, even the sensible sections of it, is that they haven't got a candidate. They will not be able to produce. They haven't been able to produce a substantially respectable and attractive candidate that actually will produce a substantial victory for them. And given that they supported the impeachment of Dilma, they supported all the shenanigans that went along with that, they supported all the neoliberal programs, you know, under Temer and now with Bolsonaro, which they did support, and they are reluctant to do anything about Bolsonaro, how can they produce anybody credible from their ranks? And this is their problem. So unless the Workers' Party is able to shift the situation in the next year or so, Brazil is going to face something quite great. And I suppose in that context, if the Workers' Party and its allies are not able to bring about a solution, such as, you know, getting rid of Bolsonaro by impeachment or some other means, legally and constitutionally, and the right wing is able to produce a candidate, then the military or section of the military will be very tempted perhaps to do something serious. I think the key as to whether it goes one way or the other is going to be determined, I suppose, by the complexion of the outcome of the election in the United States this November. We'll see what happens with that, and then that will give us a clue as to where things might go.
Can I just ask, I don't want to draw a clumsy parallel here, so please bear with me. But the kind of imposing of a neoliberal agenda and it failing horrendously reminds me a little of 1973 and Chile specifically, although this is far, far less brutal as far as the coming in is concerned. Of course, it's remember that Bolsonaro did win an election. But it seems a little like they've tried to apply these ideas, including, you know, massive cuts in public spending, which of course means, as you mentioned already, massive cuts of public jobs, public sector jobs, excuse me. Do you think there's any parallel there, or have I got that wrong?
There is a parallel in the sense that some of the policies of reducing the size of the state, which is a sort of shibboleth that neoliberals have. You know, they believe that the more the state is participates in the economy, the worse it is. And they equate or conflate or actually equate the state ownership with inefficiency and wastage. And then, you know, bureaucracy and so on. And some of them go as far as to say the more the state intervenes in the economy, then the closer we get to some sort of authoritarian, dictatorial regime, which wouldn't be imposed upon us, such as, you know, the worst you can imagine in what they see as sort of totalitarian dictatorship. And this is, in that sense, there are enormous amount of commonalities. And the idea that, you know, to support the poor with social benefits such as the Bolsa Familia program in Brazil is something that, you know, Bolsonaro got rid of it or as much as possible immediately. There are these parallels, and there is the issue of privatization. Then there is the issue of bringing in foreign investment. and so on. But that's where the battle ends. And I think the reason is this. In the case of Chile, Chile is the only, and sometimes I always cringe when I say this, it's the only successful neoliberal project in the world. I don't like it, but it's definitely successful, successful in the following way. If you think about it, Chile went into an extraordinary period of economic growth, sustained economic growth, where the economy was growing at the rate of between 6 to 8% per year for about 20 years on the basis of what they call non-traditional export. That is to say, the neoliberal project, you know, Pinochet and everything that went with it, which may be easier to implement, of course, because there was no resistance, led the country into a spiral of growth, which was, you know, impressive. 6 to 8% per year, even though there was concentration of income at the level of the top. There was what they claim to be the trickle-down effect. I mean, there was some trickle-down effect. Just to give you an idea, between, say, 1989, when democracy came back and the neoliberal project continued with the Concertación, you know, the sort of left Democrats, that perfected the system, perfected neoliberalism, that's what I mean. Poverty when Pinochet left was 43%. Today, the official figures, and these are figures that, you know, accepted by the Economic Commission for Latin America, the level of poverty in Chile is 8%. That gives you an idea of how, you know, in inverted commas, successful the model is. And then the period of growth gave huge amount of employment, generated a huge amount of employment, which was quite technical, high level, sort of skill, although there was a section of people who actually went to collect, pick up the agricultural produce, you know, on the harvest season that were paid very badly, they were given very precarious contracts. We saw in Chile the extraordinary feature that during the harvest period there will be shanty towns established in the rural areas from the urban areas. Nobody was the other way around because young people went to the farms to wait for employment during the harvest season for 3-4 months and were extremely badly paid, overworked. You can imagine, you know, they could be dismissed at any time, but nevertheless, now, there was unemployment, whereas in Brazil, people are just left destitute. I mean, the government and the state abandons them, as it were, makes them redundant, takes away their benefit, applies austerity brutally, and then people are just abandoned. And the number of people that are abandoned in Brazil, nobody knows exactly, but it's terrible. It's really high, and it's growing all the time. Remember, during the Workers' Party in Brazil, they took something like 40 million people out of poverty in a period of 6 to 8 years, which is an extraordinary feat, which demonstrates, you know, what can be done with the right policies. So the balance end there, and there is a worse aspect of it, and I think it's got to do with the decline of the United States. At the time, in 73 and so on, and onwards, when there were various neoliberal governments and military dictatorship in various Latin American countries, the United States could still provide a framework, an international framework, economically, financially, and so on, where these countries could make some progress or could grow to some degree in some reasonably sustained fashion for a while. The Chilean example is extraordinary because it's unusual. All the others, you know, just began to collapse very quickly after that. But today, the United States, which is declining so sharply and so badly and so irretrievably, is unable to provide anything except, you know, get in a very greedy fashion, whatever it can, out of this country, suck them, you know, suck all their vital energy, vital economics, vital resources, bleed them dry very quickly, and the consequence is this country begins to collapse. I mean, in Argentina, that had almost no debt, $150 million. And as a result of the application of a neoliberal model, you know, reversing the policies of expansion of the state in Argentina during the Kirchnerism and so on, led the country into a spiral of debt, which ended up with a debt in about 5 years, three years, to the extraordinary figure of $280 billion. I mean, this was the United States doing it. And the consequence was the country began to collapse. And, you know, Fernandez now has a terrible job to try to recover the nation from that situation. Bolsonaro is doing something worse in a much faster period. Sorry, much faster in a shorter period. So there is no parallel where the neoliberal model that was applied by Pinochet is similar. And when it comes to the, I think, a crucial dimension, which is possibly that it would be interesting to know about, is will they be able to actually implement the levels of repression that Pinochet implemented in Chile, you know, during the worst years of the dictatorship for 17 years? And would they be able to do that in Brazil? Even if the military were to play a bigger role, I doubt very much that they would be able to do it. And the reason is this. In Chile, we were crushed. We were defeated. Our parties were outlawed. Our leaders were assassinated. You know, people were forced to push out of the country. All the institutions that took us 50 years to build, trade unions, organizations of the social movement, a core culture of democracy, was destroyed in no time at all. And it was destroyed very brutally. And it was demolished, you know, during the years of the military dictatorship. And in Brazil, although Bolsonaro is very nasty, and what they've done is terrible and it's not nice at all, they haven't been able to reproduce a context in which a Pinochet style of solution is possible. The movement remains pretty entire. The Workers' Party is still quite a formidable force. It's making alliances with other political parties which haven't been outlawed, even though they are persecuted, but nothing like what is going on in Bolivia. So it's much milder in that sense. And the military will not be able to do that, because between now and when and if the military are able to do something, say after the election or re-election of Trump, if that happens, they will not be able to actually just go for the killing, assassination, outlawing, and so on. It will be too much, and it will be unsustainable politically. So that's why there are important parallels, but there are tremendous limitations. I'm, in that sense, remain quite optimistic. Not necessarily that we're going to impose or bring about socialism in Brazil, but I think we can recover a substantial amount of the terrain lost. And what gives me the confidence to say this is, number one, I thought that Mexico was completely lost, you know, forever after the shenanigans, the cartels, the domination by the United States under the PRI. And now we have López Obrador, who is reversing that quite nicely and quite steadily. And then I thought in Argentina, you know, the possibilities of coming back will be almost nil. And now we have, you know, Alberto Fernandez there trying to establish all sort of coordinations in Latin America and certainly reversing as much as he can, as quickly as he can, of what is going on, what went on before in Argentina with Macri. So, and Brazil plays a central role in coordination with these political forces in the region. And that's why I think it's not the same. We'll see what happens, but I'm quite optimistic.
Yeah, and solidarity to the good people of Brazil, and in particular the indigenous people there who are suffering through so much of this. As we've mentioned Chile already, last year, of course, quite late last year, there was a big rebellion that kicked off, an uprising in that country, against, if I remember rightly, quite a lot of government failure in regards, I think a train fare rise is the thing that kicked it off. I remember we talked about this on the show before.
Sure.
What's going on with that right now? Because the international press seems to have been quite quiet on that subject recently.
Yeah. The government, Piñera's government, you know, the first one and this is the second one, characterizes itself by not doing anything. In the previous administration, he didn't do much. And at one point, you know, the political establishment, the political class, the media and so were saying, what is he doing? What's he done? You know, he's the president, he hasn't done nothing. And it's true, the system in Chile at that time was, the neoliberal system was so perfected, it worked so well, that the president didn't need to do anything for the system to run perfectly well. And the idiot, if I can, I think it's a correct expression in that case, appropriate. The idiot decided he had to leave some mark and decided to go for the further privatization of the education system, attacking universities, and produce one of the most impressive, you know, University of Students Rebellion, where the student actually brought society out into the streets, parents, trade unions, and others, and they were able to challenge a significant component of the neoliberal agenda, which was the further, you know, complete privatization of education, so much so that it led Michelle Bachelet to adopt as part of her agenda to give free education to all levels of society, primary school, secondary school, and university level, which she began to implement, and, you know, began to implement quite seriously. There is a private sector in the education in Chile, which doesn't have to apply necessarily this, but she began to implement. In other words, Piñera, by trying to do something, messed it up. On this occasion, he tried to do the same. Is this true that Chile was a bit constrained, the Chilean economy was a bit constrained by a reduction in the export, particularly of copper because of the 2008 world crisis, which was hitting, you know, raw material producing nations such as Chile? And then he decided to apply some serious, reasonably brutal, not very brutal, but reasonably brutal neoliberal package. 30%, one of the key manifestations of which was the 30% increase in the fares of public transport. And, you know, secondary school kids went into a rampage and they brought the whole society to stand still and mobilized so many. I remember when we talked about this in the show last time, you know, they mobilized nearly 2 million people in the streets of Santiago. Chile has a population of 17 million people overall. And if you have a demonstration in Chile, people from the provinces do not travel to Santiago for the demo like in the UK. They just stay where they are. So the demonstration was basically Santiago. And ever since, the system has been under crisis, the political system, and the challenge to the neoliberal system has been absolutely fantastic. I mean, people say it's not only 30%, it's 30 years that they've been taking advantage of us, and we want a new, different model. And they began to make all sorts of proposals, you know, from all over the place. Proposals began to emerge from trade unions, pensioners, students, working classes, intellectuals, economists, and so on. And it was extraordinary. And this began to sort of take shape. It was a bit messy at the beginning, a bit disorderly. But, you know, when you have a process like that, this is inevitable. Yeah. And this began to take shape in a sort of agenda that began to shape. And the crucial thing was what the political institutions, you know, at the level of Congress and at the level of Senate were going to respond to this. Of course, the right wing responded with repression. The government applied repression. It was so brutal, disgusting, horrible. They used this technique, which was, I think, instituted by civilized France under Macron, which is to use rubber, to fire rubber bullets into people's faces and then blind them. Mm-hmm. And some, you know, the number of people in Chile that got serious injury into their eyes, some, many of them losing one eye, some of them losing the two, was in the region of 435, if my figures are correct. And therefore, you know, this was so brutal and many people were killed and so on. Young people were arrested. We're talking about 15, 16, 13, and they were raped by the cops. And this was denounced and formal charges were made into court by human rights lawyers and the number of young women that were also raped, and also the people were brutalized, was just terrible. And the government, I think, at the right wing, thought that these they had it because they managed to brutally repress the system, but it didn't work. The masses continued to come out in the streets, and the pandemic hit the nation. And it was a sort of blessing to the government because suddenly people could not come out. It was dangerous, it was risky, and you know the population took their, went home, and the government applied very, very restrictive lockdown system, which tried to combine with opening up business so that the economy didn't suffer that much and produce terrible results. Just to give you information about this, the number of people contaminated in Chile is 345,000, and which is very, very high, and the number of people who have died is 9,124. Chile is one of the highest countries in terms of contamination because there is no serious public health sector in the country. So therefore, if you're contaminated, you're more or less on your own, even though now the government began to take some steps towards it. And the masses, particularly the young, began to realize, began to get fed up with the government using the pandemic in order to delay the political crisis that we're facing. So they began to make demonstrations and they raised all sorts of issues, and it came down into one, which I think is it absolutely perfect because it goes to the heart of the neoliberal model of Chile, which is the private pension system called AFP, which has been ripping people off for the last 30 years. The way it works is that you pay and pay and pay your contribution for 30 years, and then when you claim the pension, they take you to a litigation, the companies, or whoever it is, they take you into litigation. In fact, I have relatives of mine in Chile who have suffered these themselves. They take you into litigation because they're powerful and the legislation that exists is such that, you know, you as an individual worker, after you pay so much pension contribution for 30 years, don't stand a chance. Your lawyers are extremely expensive and you don't have all the resources to be able to sustain a long, protracted legal case. And the consequence of that, they end up denying you most of your pension. So you end up with a pension which is something like sometimes 10%, sometimes 20%, sometimes even less of what your income was at the time when you actually were pensioned off. So that gives you an idea of how terrible it is. And these monies, which have been accumulated by hedge funds in the country, there are about five or six groups that actually have all of the money. They use this money to speculate in the stock exchange internationally in all sorts of adventures. You can imagine how it is. So the movement very cleverly, but I think very wise, very cleverly, but also cunningly concentrated on this, and they said what they wanted the government in the context of the pandemic. They wanted the government to take a decision, and the institution, particularly Congress and the Senate, to take a decision to actually return to every single pension person who has been making pension contributions to these funds, that they return to them 10%, so that they can survive during the period of the pandemic, to be renewed and reviewed, to be rediscussed if the pandemic lasts longer than expected and that 10% sustains, which is extraordinary. The government went potty. And this began to affect political parties because one senator, a guy called Alejandro Navarro, who I know personally, was very left-wing, he started the 10% proposal in the Senate. And then this, if I may use that word, contaminated the Congress. And he tried correctly not only to bring the left together behind it, which he did, but also to try to persuade the Socialist Party, which is sort of center-left of the political spectrum, to support it. And extraordinary, I mean, you know, to cut the long story short, a week ago, something like that, 10 days ago, the Congress took a decision by supporting the 10%. So it became a position of the Congress and it went to the Senate. In the Congress, the right wing is less strong than in the Senate. So the calculation that everybody made, including myself, was, well, they'll be able to stop it in the Senate. It's good that we've done this, but, you know, we're not going to get too far, so we can denounce them for being terrible and so on. And it went to the Senate, and extraordinarily, the Senate, because several right-wing senators defected to this position, supported the 10%. And now Piñera, the president of the Republic, has the terrible decision that either supports him, therefore legislate, because, you know, that's what the two chambers actually have passed, or vetoes the legislation and thereby exacerbating the political crisis that he faces and the total isolation, because now his right wing is beginning to fragment. And economists from the right, when confronted with this 10% agreement, they said that, you know, this is the end of the neoliberal system and so on. I think they're right, even though they were exaggerating the point from a right-wing point of view. I think they're right. These deals a lethal blow to the neoliberal system. And now that they have the legitimacy of congressional and senatorial support, I think it's going to be impossible for the government to recover. And I think the right-wing is going to begin to fragment even further, because, you know, they are now entering into a massive crisis that they don't know what to do after this 10%. How do they stop the people from saying, we want this pension system to finance X, Y, and Z in society? You know, we want more decent pensions. We want the legislation to be changed. You can imagine this opens the gates, the floodgates, to all imaginable changes. And finally, they got the point that they wanted at the beginning when they began the insurrection or rebellion, I think it's more correct to say, some, you know, earlier on last year, which is they want a new model and they're going to get it. And therefore, from there, they're going to move, and he's already talked about this, of a new constitution, because the Chilean constitution is the constitution legated to the government by Augusto Pinochet in 1980. So the prospect was very impressive. And hopefully soon enough, either by as a result of a massive crisis which the right wing are facing, and therefore leading to an election, electing a government which is more in tune with López Obrador in Mexico and Fernández in Argentina to reverse the worst aspects of neoliberalism in Chile, And in the next elections, we could be in 2 or 3 years, and then, you know, electing such government, because the right wing has very little possibilities, and the chances of a coup d'etat in Chile are zilch. I don't think it's possible at all. So, good stuff.
Yeah, that's some positive news there. You mentioned in that story, and in also when we're talking about Brazil, we did mention COVID-19. I just wanted to speak quickly about how that takes over the whole region. Which country, we know which countries perhaps are doing not so well, but which countries are doing better in regards infection, lower death rates, treatment, etc.? Where is it going?
There are three. I mean, most of the countries, Ecuador, most of the countries where there have been neoliberal domination and, you know, no public sector health system and so on, they're suffering enormously. Brazil is the worst, but certainly Mexico, which inherited, you know, the previous system, and López Obrador trying to deal with it, perhaps not in the best way, is also being hit quite hard. Ecuador, certainly Chile, and so on. But the three countries that actually come out extremely well would be Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. The number of cases in Venezuela is 14,000 contaminated. Compared to, you know, all the other countries, is very small. And the number of people who have died so far is around 140. It's interesting, about 50 to 60% of those cases are from people who are coming back from places where xenophobic, they suffered xenophobia, persecution and destitution, you know, in as migrants in Peru, Chile, Brazil, Ecuador, and Colombia. They're coming back to the country because they know they're going to get a good system, health system, they're being going to be protected. And as they come back, they are contaminated. So the number of cases out of these 14,000 total is about 60% of them that come from outside. Nevertheless, you know, the figures will be around, I suppose, 6,000, 5,000, which are what they call communitarian contamination. That's very, very impressive indeed. And the reason why they've been able to do this is because they have a very well-developed public sector system with the support of China, with masks and tests particularly. Venezuela, I think, was the country carried out most of the tests proportionally compared to many other countries in the world. So, you know, the more you carry tests, the easier it is to actually cover it. And the public sector system, the public health public sector system is such that about 40,000 beds are available for these people. And, you know, it's only 14,000 which are contaminated, and most of them are likely to become very seriously ill. Cuba has, I'm sort of looking for a figure, it's about 2,500. I think most of the numbers in Cuba is the result of tourism. Many tourists were in the island when the pandemic hit them. And many people were coming from European countries where the contamination was going on, and nobody had been taken as a result of that. You know, they contaminated some Cubans. And the total number of people dead, I think, is about 89 in Cuba, which is quite slow. Nicaragua has, I don't know, I think it's, the figure is in the region of 1,500. I don't want to get these figures wrong, but it's quite low. And the number of people who have died is in the region of 85, something like 50, 85. It's quite low. And again, the reason is, I think there are two reasons for it. There's no lockdown in Nicaragua. Nevertheless, the level of health provision with vaccines, 18 vaccines every year, to the whole population, year in, year out, ever since Ortega came back to office in 2007, the level of, you know, the food intake of the population is extremely healthy. Nicaragua is 90% self-sufficient in their own food, so it's organic, and therefore the health quality of the population are quite high. And that's why people suggest, and doctors and others in the health system in Nicaragua suggest, this is the reason why no need for lockdown is necessary, although some restrictions are taken. The number of visits, more than 4 million visits to families and to communities and to individuals all over the country, regularly all the time, guarantees that if anybody were to have shown any symptoms, you know, he's immediately attended from the health experts, and everything in Cuba and Venezuela and Nicaragua, all health attention, absolutely everything, 100% of it is totally free. So therefore the population can relax and they're very heavily protected. And it clearly shows that where the country has a public sector health system and where the government applies policies to support the population, that is to say, put people before profits, the results are pretty impressive, even though it's impossible to be completely free of the contamination. Whereas in the other countries, where the opposite is the case, such as the United States, which is the worst possible case, you know, the consequences are devastating. I don't know how many more people are going to contaminate it. If the curve in the United States is still going up. So if there is any lesson that we can draw from this, it's exactly that. Put people before profit and have the system that ensure that that actually takes place, such as in Nicaragua, in Venezuela, and in Cuba. And the interesting thing in the case of Cuba, but also particularly in the case of Venezuela, is that Venezuela is doing this and they're under siege by the sanctions from the United States.
Indeed. And also, it's worth remembering that Cuba, as ever, has not kept its great doctors to themselves. They have supported internationally, including in Italy, where I believe they've been nominated for Nobel Peace Prize or something similar.
Yeah, there is a huge international campaign, and I voted already, you know, for the Henry Reeve Brigade, which is that they sent. Henry Reeve was a revolutionary who fought in, I think he's a U.S. citizen, fought in their revolutions in the past. And that's why they named their brigade that way, because it's internationalism. And in Italy, they paid homage to them in Turin, in the highest tower in Turin, in the center of town, you know, thank you, grazie Cuba, thank you Cuba, with huge lights and so on. You know, the whole country is absolutely grateful, but also Spain and other countries. Cuba is in that sense magnificent. You know, it's the only country, well, it's one of the few countries that gives solidarity anywhere. I take all the risk and takes nothing back in exchange. Quite the opposite, it's totally selfless and totally altruistic, you know. My hat's off to them.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the thing with doctors especially is one of those things where I will debate the Cuban political system with people of good faith actors. I'm not in love with everything that goes on there. I don't think it's perfect. I have problems with it. But when people knock a country with 100% literacy and a healthcare system that, as you said, puts people before profit, including internationally, if there's not going to be an admission of that being an admirable thing, I'm not interested in the debate. it kind of goes both ways. Yeah. I'm not going to waste my time with somebody who's just going to badmouth it on a political front.
A great deal of the distortions and problems that Cuba has in terms of not having a perfect system come from the, you know, nasty aggression from the United States 90 miles away. I'm sure that if somebody were to guarantee, with a bona fide guarantee, that, you know, the United States is going to stop organizing aggression, I'm sure the Cubans will relax and all sorts of other things. You know, they will be able to perfect the system, but they cannot relax. As a result of that, they have to take these decisions, which sometimes, you know, produce imperfections here and there. Although I must say, there is no perfect system in the world, as far as I know.
Francisco Dominguez, thank you once again for being on All the Rage. You're always welcome here. I'm very happy to say this on the air. Your level of knowledge is really admirable and life enriching. I really feel like the last hour has taught me a lot that I didn't know already.
Oh, thanks so much for that.
I appreciate that. And most importantly, I appreciate you sharing it with myself and the listeners. It really means a lot to me. So thank you for being on again. You're welcome back anytime. And just to say, solidarity forever.
All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.